Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there. Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, and affiliate of Law and Public Affairs.
There's one single comparison that has been made again and again in recent months. It's been between the Trump presidency and the presidency of Richard Nixon. From the start of his term, we've heard all sorts of comparisons, discussions about how Richard Nixon had campaigned on issues of law and order, how he had tried to win Democratic voters through different kinds of appeals, his temperament, and of course, most importantly, the current scandal that has unfolded has led to discussions and memories of what happened back in the early 1970s, from the actual issues that started the Watergate scandal to the issue of obstruction of justice to the ultimate resignation of Richard Nixon. So we thought it would be a great opportunity to go back and revisit the Nixon presidency and Watergate. And today, to talk with us about this, we have really one of the best people we could imagine, and that's Elizabeth Drew, who has been covering American politics since the 1970s. She's written for The Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books. She's been a popular commentator on television, including PBS. And she's published 15 books, including a classic, which all political historians read at some point. And it has been reissued recently with a new foreword. And that is, of course, Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's Downfall, which is a firsthand account of the scandal that reshaped American politics. So thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
So maybe we can just start by your reminding our listeners about the Washington Journal book itself in terms of its format and why you wrote it and the context of that publication.
The book grew out of an assignment that I got from William Shawn, the justly legendary editor of The New Yorker. And I was talking to him around the Labor Day weekend of 1973, and he said to me, "What are you thinking of writing about?" And I said, "I must be a witch." I said, "Mr. Shawn, I think we are going to change presidents and vice presidents within the year." Hmm. Now, Spiro Agnew, the then vice president, was in legal trouble. And for sitting in his office in the executive office building and taking bribes from Maryland contractors that he had worked out when he was governor. The president was in some trouble. The Watergate break-in had happened, and we knew there were difficulties there. But impeachment was really not on hardly anyone's lips at the time, one or two more, radical left members of the House, but it really wasn't there. And Sean, his eyes widened, he said, "Do you really think so?" And I said, "I just have this instinct about it." So we agreed that I would cover this in journal form. We didn't know, where it was going to lead or how long it was going to take. But as he said to me, the great editors are very curious people. And he said, "We have no idea how to change vice presidents. We've never done that before." And of course, we hadn't impeached the president, but we weren't focused on that yet. But I just felt that Nixon was not going to last.
And that's interesting because that was at the time that you had that conversation with Mr. Shawn. It was, as you say, Labor Day 1973. So that's after many of the facts of the Watergate break-in were known, but before President Nixon fired Archibald Cox.
Well, that's the point. So, and also the Sam Ervin's committee, a special committee in the Senate, had held hearings, and they were, they paraded before the country some of these bizarre people and his White House staff. They weren't all bizarre, but they were a little alarming. So the public was getting familiar, so we didn't know what was going to happen. And the Agnew story, played out, and he did have to be replaced, but he was replaced by Gerald Ford. And then on October 20th, this was early September, on October 20th was when the key thing, well, there's a couple of key things to tell you about Watergate, but we'll do this first. It had been found that the president had taped his conversations in the Oval Office, and Congress had already appointed a special prosecutor, independent counsel, he was called at the time, a man named Archibald Cox, who had been a scary Harvard law professor. And I sat in class with a boyfriend at Harvard Law School, and he terrified everybody. But in any event, this was a different Archibald Cox we saw on October 20th, which is the point. He had subpoenaed the tapes, and Nixon had said, no, you can't have them. So we were having this collision, and Archie Cox got on television, and he was all shucks. He was kind of Jimmy Stewart kind of character all of a sudden. And I'm getting too big for my britches. I don't want to do that. And I, me, take on a president. Well, he was very shrewd. And so he was demanding that Nixon turn over the tapes, and Nixon was saying no. And so then Nixon had to fire him because they were at this collision point. But he couldn't fire him directly. He had to get the attorney general to fire him. Now, this may have a little resonance for the current period. It's the same thing. If Trump were to fire Bob Mueller, he couldn't do it. He'd have to get his attorney general to do it. As we know, Mr. Sessions isn't in a position to do that. And anyway, that's for later. So that night, actually, I was on television, Saturday night television program. Usually we taped it, but on the day before, but this was Saturday night live, actually. And the bulletin started to come in. Nixon calls on Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, to fire Cox. Richardson refuses and resigns because he was going to be fired. The next one up, Bill Ruckelshaus, the deputy attorney general, he refuses and resigns. And then the next in line at the Justice Department, a name that may have some resonance, was Robert Bork. And he fired Cox, and that was that, except that the FBI went in and sealed off their offices. It was a terrifying time. It felt like we were in a coup d'etat. A Latin American coup was going on. It was very frightening. That's one thing about Watergate that's different from now. There's a different kind of fright now, but then we were really terrified of this president and what he might do, because we just didn't know what his limits were.
You have a great entry about this, where you say, it's a spectacularly beautiful day. This is October 20th, warm and spring-like. It's unfair to have to give it up for a constitutional crisis. Besides, it's a Saturday, and Washington's supposed to stop on Saturdays. And this is really important. The term constitutional crisis has been overused in the course of the past year. And then you wrote, but this may be the real thing.
And it was. And that is the point about Watergate. Watergate has been mythologized as a kind of detective story. It's because of Bob Woodward and Carol Bernstein did fabulous reporting. That's not taking away from them at all. But the way they depict it is because they came in with the Watergate break-in. This was the break-in of the Democratic National Headquarters in the Watergate office building. There's a complex of buildings there, as you know. But actually, and then Alan Pakula made this wonderful movie out of their book, All the President's Men, which, by the way, I'm in a little, there's a little scene there with me interviewing somebody for a PBS television program I did. But anyway, that's my movie career. the point is that we did have a constitutional crisis. It was how do you keep a president, how do you make a president accountable? That's really what that was about. That's really what we may be heading for in this case. But in fact, there had already been a more serious and more important break-in before the Watergate break-in. And that was of the office, now just think about this, hold your seatbelts, the office of the psychiatrist to Daniel Ellsberg, who had released the Pentagon Papers. And Nixon was huffing mad about that. Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor at the time, was furious, and he was goading Nixon. And they were going to get Ellsberg. Nixon did this we don't have now.
And this is just for our listeners. This is in September 1971. So it's 2 years earlier.
73.
No, the break-in.
Oh, the break-in. Yes,
the break-in was 2 years
right.
earlier. And this is fascinating that happened during Nixon's first term, before his reelection. And you're talking about the galvanizing moment being 2 years later. So I just want to give people a timeline on when the break-in happened.
That's very useful. And Actually, I started reading some of the transcripts when Nixon was in Florida, Key Biscayne, where he had a house, when the Watergate break-in occurred. And he came back to Washington 3 days later. And he met with his top assistant, really, Bob Haldeman. And they were discussing what to do. And Nixon said, the problem with the Cubans, which is what they call this group of people, this little group of thugs who had been betrayed by Kennedy at the Bay of Pigs, and they were still angry, and they wanted to get the commies and all that sort of thing. And they had been hired by somebody in the White House to do break-ins and, you know, black bag jobs. I mean, it was horrendous. Just think about it. And they were paid for through contributions and things, but they were going around doing these things. And they had broken into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. Now, what saved us is these people were totally incompetent. They messed up everything they did. So it turned out there were no files. They wanted to get Ellsberg's files, his psychiatric files, and use them against him. But, well, there weren't any files in this doctor's office. They had supposedly cased it, but they weren't there. So,
and this is Gordon Liddy and I forget who else, right?
Hunt.
Oh, Hunt. Right, Hunt.
Well, they were running it, but they had these sort of five Cubans working for them. Well,
All right, so the Cubans are there. They find nothing.
Oh, the point is that Nixon and Haldeman, Nixon would say, well, the problem with the Cubans is they were doing that other thing. And so that's why they did the cover-up. Nixon, quite rightly, I feel, felt that the Ellsberg psychiatrist's office, his name was Dr. Lewis Fielding, that was far more serious and actionable than the Watergate break-in. And it had come up in the Irvin hearings. A Southern senator said to John Ehrlichman, who was another very powerful Nixon White House aide, "Mr. Ehrlichman, whatever happened to the concept, the Fourth Amendment, a man's home is his castle?" And Ehrlichman said that's been seriously eroded over the years, which was a terrifying moment, concept. So Nixon felt they had to do a cover-up because the plumbers had done the break-in of the psychiatrist's office. That's really why they did the cover-up, because they knew this other thing. And so that's how it really got started.
And do we know now, with hindsight, do we know whether Nixon was aware of that break-in at the time that it happened, or was it just, you know, giving an instruction to a loyal henchman
about the Dr. Fielding break-in, yes, he did know about that.
I see.
Now, people, it's a good question, though, because people say, well, did Nixon know about the Watergate break-in, or did he direct it? And my answer is fairly surprising. It doesn't matter. We'll get to this, but one of the really important concepts in the article, the three articles of impeachment that were drawn up against Nixon, was Article 2, which went by the concept, this was new, that a president can be held accountable for the acts of his aides. So, you know, no more winking and nodding and, not saying anything and not saying anything, you get caught. If the White House Nixon's White House was so arranged that people understood that he wanted these things done. And so if he said to them, as he did several times, "I want to get the goods on Larry O'Brien." Larry O'Brien was the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Nixon was very big on getting the goods on people. Hmm. And so they took their signal and did it. It didn't matter whether he knew about it beforehand. I think he probably did not and didn't want to. But he told them what to do. And that's what was so significant about that Article 2.
Now, let's see. Now, I just wanted to, I think we're going to turn to another topic in just a moment. But I just wanted to just clarify something about the emotional feeling of this. You're saying that at the time of the Saturday Night Massacre in October 1973, was this galvanizing moment of crisis that got everyone upset. But if I'm understanding the timeline correctly, many of the facts about these break-ins, first the psychiatrist's office, second at the Democratic National Committee headquarters, and then finally FBI investigation, all of that is known in October 72, before Nixon's reelection. So if I'm reading this correctly, many of the facts of these offenses were known a full year earlier. So why is it that the Saturday Night Massacre, this firing, why is that the moment of crisis?
They were known, but they weren't focused on.
Ah, okay, all right.
And here was a man who, you know, was about to win an election by, you know, like 97% of the vote. I mean, it wasn't that, but it was an enormously one-sided election. Now, this is important, too. It may not seem to be. It's not quite Watergate, but it gives you the sense of this period. I think one of the most alarming things that happened during this whole time was that one of the things that the plumbers were doing and some others were the Nixon White House, they said, what Democrat do we want to run against? And they worked, they did various dirty tricks and break-ins and things to disqualify or to get out of the race, who was presumably the strongest candidate, Ed Buskey, senator from Maine at the time. And they did a number of things to get to who would be the opposition party's nominee. They were sort of the Russia of that period, only more so. It was all out there. And so, to me, this way lies fascism. When you have the party in power using its various instruments to dictate who the other opposition party is going to nominate. And they nominated George McGovern, very nice man, lovely man, but very liberal. And he was he was the weakest candidate to run against Nixon, and he got beaten very, very badly.
One of the heroes of the Watergate story often is Congress, and the Irving Committee is usually depicted as key force in ultimately changing public opinion and putting pressure on the president. Yet what was interesting upon rereading the book was this was not inevitable, and there are many points where you're raising questions as it unfolds about how Congress will stand up to this challenge. And in your first entry, I believe, I think it's September 4th, 1973, you wrote, "All year the Congress has bobbed and weaved and has only taken an occasional jab at the president. The Irving Committee has shown signs of losing its nerve and direction. Congress has yet done nothing concrete to change the conditions that made possible that spreading cluster of events which have been coming to light or to prevent these things from happening again." Did it take Congress longer than we remember to fulfill its obligations in this constitutional crisis? And did it actually fulfill that role in the way we remember?
It did eventually and barely, but it did. But to back up, and just one thing I want to fill out what we were talking about October 20th, is that's when the word impeachment really took hold. And that's when it got to be a serious possibility. So that was the real change. Now, yes, I wasn't as enchanted with the Irving Committee as people generally were. They were very important, as I said before, in showing the country this cast of characters that were in the White House. And they did raise questions. But I said they bobbed and weaved, well, Congress did. But the Irving Committee never quite clamped it down. Now, they were just authorized to hold these hearings. But now here's a shattering point, and that is Howard Baker has gone down in history. People keep using this, where he was the Republican leader on that committee. The Democrats controlled the Congress at that point, which is a key point. Baker kept saying, what did the president know, and when did he know it? And somehow that took on the accolade that this was a wonderful question and it really pinned it down. It was actually a very narrowing question. And Baker was working with the White House because he was setting it up. Unless you could say exactly when the president knew what, there was no case. And so he was really trying to limit what Congress, what they could act on. So I wish people would sort of get wise about that because they keep using it as this wonderful, heroic question. It was anything but.
But I mean, that's really, I think, a different way than most people think of Baker. And it
that's
also just.
That's why I said it.
Right. But it brings up a bigger question, which obviously today is always a discussion. But kind of how long did Richard Nixon's support continue into this crisis? I mean, did it erode quickly, or was there a similarity in terms of Republican support held longer than we remember with Nixon? And there were still a lot of Republicans, including the Bakers, who were pretty loyal in trying to curb this investigation. Was there more partisan loyalty than we seem to think?
Well, you raise a very good point, because what we have to get to now is the real action happened in the House Judiciary Committee. That's where the issue was really joined, and that's what made the enormous difference. Irvin, you know, paraded these people, but they didn't really do anything. But the House Judiciary Committee was given the jurisdiction to proceed on the question of impeaching the president. And they were just sort of getting going and getting organized. It didn't really begin until early the following year. Now, in answer to your question, yes, Nixon had a following and he had a base, but it eroded over time. I would caution, though, it was a different kind of base than what Trump has. In Nixon's time, we didn't have Fox News. We didn't even have cable. We didn't have the kind of talk shows of the Limbaughs of the world. We didn't have that then. Trump has more instruments for keeping his base loyal, and he's been more overt about it. We need to go down that road now, but that it's just a very different relationship with the base and a different kind of base. I do think that Trump's base is starting to erode, and it will continue to erode. Whether it will get as low as Nixon's did, I can't say now, but we didn't know ahead of time that Nixon's would. But Nixon had a base until he didn't, and he really lost the base after that, well into the next year, when various disclosures occurred, if you want to go into that.
Well, there are so many differences in the partisan landscape there between relative
right.
bipartisanship of that time and polarization of this time. But let me just read out some polling data from that time. The Gallup organization polled job approval of presidents, as they have since, I think, Eisenhower or Truman. And right after Nixon's re-inauguration, he was at his peak approval rating of 67%, which is an unthinkable number now. And then that's at the beginning of 73. And so all that time during the facts of the break-ins coming to light in 72, his approval stayed between in the 50s or the 60s. Then, after re-inauguration, starting in January, starting a slide, and by the time we get to summer of 73, he's down to 40%. So it's a pretty precipitous drop. And then, at the time of the Saturday Night Massacre, he's in the 30s, which is about where Trump is now. So that's a pretty large drop. And Nixon, by the time he resigned, I would say that he hit what I would call bottom for that time, you know, into the 30 and below range shortly after the Saturday Night Massacre. So it's really after that galvanizing moment of constitutional crisis that Nixon's approval ratings finally bottom out. And so it seemed like he was on a long slide before that.
What was it by the time, let's take June or July of the following year, the House Judiciary Committee was about to vote the articles of impeachment? What was his standing then?
Well, then he was really in the dumps. He was below 30, and at the time he left office, it was around 24%, 25%.
Okay.
So really, most of his fall had happened around the time of the Saturday Night Massacre, and then he just stayed low. It was just this. The graph is remarkably flat at that point.
But.
Yeah.
The Saturday Night Massacre, and as I said, the word impeachment began to be tossed around. It still didn't seem likely. This was a wild concept. It was a frightening concept. We had no idea what that would mean. We'd had one impeachment proceeding in the country's history, and that was Andrew Johnson after the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln's vice president, who then succeeded him when Lincoln was assassinated. And it was a highly partisan impeachment process. So there was no precedent. Nobody knew what to do. So
that's different now.
That's right.
Right.
Except it could be misunderstood. I mean, the Bill Clinton impeachment was, again, a very partisan impeachment and really should not be followed as a precedent at all. But the Nixon impeachment process, as we know, I mean, he wasn't ultimately impeached. He left office because it was clear he was going to be impeached. And impeachment is like an indictment. in the House of Representatives, and then the Senate, by a two-thirds vote, votes whether to convict. And when Nixon left office, because the congressional leaders, Republicans, told him he was going to be indicted and convicted. And he wouldn't, among other things, he wouldn't have preserved his pension. And so he wouldn't have been able to had he been convicted.
No pension, no staff.
That's right.
Right, so he needed to keep those.
We need to back up on how did this, I think the most important and fascinating period in this whole saga is how that House committee got itself together and passed articles of impeachment on bipartisan votes. See, that was the big difference. By the time you got to the votes on the articles of impeachment, Nixon had a few holdouts, but as time went on, really not very many at all. And that's a big difference from now. It, you know, raises questions as to what could be done now. But well, that's for another time. Peter Rodino, an obscure congressman from New Jersey, had just taken over the House Judiciary Committee as its chair. And nobody knew much about him, and he was New Jersey, so the White House put out that he was mobbed up, which he was not. But he was not a famous person at all. He was very untested. And they had the old committee had a counselor who was a very partisan Democrat. It had been a pretty partisan committee under Rodino's predecessor, Mr. Seller. In any event, Rodino and a couple of aides got together, and they hired a very interesting figure to be the counsel of the committee. And this was crucial. His name was John Doar, D-O-A-R. And he had been in the Eisenhower Justice Department and the Bobby Kennedy Justice Department. And he had been enforcing civil rights laws in the South. His integrity was impeccable, and he was a nonpartisan figure. So John Doar and Rodino and one or two others, you know, how to do this? They said, if Nixon is going to be impeached, it has to come from the center. The country will never accept it if it's a partisan proceeding. And so that meant that there were Democrats on the left in that committee who wanted to go much further. And they had to be, you know, blocked out. And the real work went on between more moderate Democrats. Some were quite liberal, like Paul Sarbanes of Maryland, but they were more reasonable people, and some moderate Republicans. So what you saw and what I show in the book, it was a remarkable series of events, is these people got together and they wrote the articles of impeachment together. And it was an amazing process when you saw it. And there was no vengeance. Some people felt vengeance, of course, but it was frightening. Removing a president from office should be a very alarming concept. And it was. I mean, it was taken very seriously by the core people who were taking it who were working on it. And so ideas like impeaching him for the invasion of Cambodia, no, because that was a policy issue. And they drew up articles of impeachment on processes. I've mentioned Article 2. Article 1 was obstruction of justice with various acts. You don't do it on one act. Like, Clinton was impeached for lying to the grand jury. It's a one-off thing. This committee, the House Judiciary Committee, is very careful. They were looking for pattern and practice. They kept using that term, pattern and practice, of flouting their constitutional obligations or failing to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So they kept grounding it in the Constitution. I mean, for weeks we had a tutorial on what the Founding Fathers meant when they wrote into the Constitution a president can be impeached on treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Well, what did high crimes mean? What did they mean? The critical thing about impeachment is it is not a criminal proceeding. So the independent counsel can come up with charges against the president if they're going to do it, but they can't prosecute him. So those go to the committee. Those go to the House. But there are other offenses that aren't, strictly speaking, crimes. They're offenses against the Constitution. They're offenses against the polity, as Alexander Hamilton kept pointing out. It was abrogation of one's constitutional responsibilities. This was very serious, and they spent weeks educating all of us and debating what did James Madison mean, and it was really quite thrilling in its way. So this was very carefully thought out, and it was bipartisan. It did come from the center, but I had to tell you, there wasn't joy. I was there. I was through all of it. But Article 1 was adopted on a Saturday evening, and when they called the members of the committee, I mean, it was very solemn. There was not another sound in that room, and nobody was looking joyous. And Peter, after they voted the first article of impeachment, Peter Rodino went in the back room and cried. I mean, it was so tense, and it was so momentous and awesome that it was taken very seriously. And whether that could ever be recaptured, I don't know. Article 2 was a series of acts that went on that were done by Nixon or by the people around him. And this was, where I say, the crucial thing that happened there was, after much discussion, they concluded that a president can be and actually must be held accountable for the actions of his aides. Now, not just one thing or one aide, but there was this whole atmosphere of, you know, almost anything goes. And this allows the Congress and the people to hold a president accountable for things that his underlings do. If, again, there's a pattern in practice, and you can see that it wouldn't happen if a president wasn't at the least allowing it to happen.
So,
and then the third was another process question about obstruction, about defying the committee subpoenas and things like that. It wasn't as important. But I have to tell you, this was just incredibly momentous time, and it was very serious. It did come from the center. It was bipartisan. Otherwise, it never would have gone down as peacefully as it did. I mean, you still have diehards who say Nixon was run out of office by the liberal Washington Post, you know. But there'll always be some of those. But it was really a very minor segment of the country. It was accepted as the right thing to do, and that was critical.
Does impeachment have to come from the House?
Yes, it starts in the House. Okay. It's in the Constitution.
Right. And so if we look at these things that you just described, pattern and practice. So, for instance, saying something at a campaign rally encouraging the Russians to look into Hillary's emails, that's not a pattern. That's just a single statement. On the other hand, say if there's some action on the part of an entire campaign or multiple members of staff to get into bed with the Russians, hypothetically, then that would be a pattern. I'm just looking for ways of understanding this idea of pattern or practice.
Those would all be in one article.
Right. Okay.
In other words, there would be an article about Kemp.
So the idea would be undermining the security of American elections. That would be
a pattern. That's right. Or working with a foreign power,
yeah,
not to mention a hostile one, to affect our election. That's the collusion argument. So those would all be in one article. And so it would be a collection of Trump saying to Russia, look into Hillary's emails. Just be one of, you know, maybe 5 or 6 or 10. We don't know yet. The meeting in Trump Tower where they talked to the Russian lady lawyer who said she would give them dirt on Hillary Clinton. We're not sure yet whether she did or not. And Donald Jr. has kept saying, well, nothing came of the meeting. But we don't know that. That's not been proven yet. I'm sure that Mueller is looking. I know he's looking into it. So, it's unlike the Bill Clinton lying to the grand jury. It's not any kind of one-off action. That would be a collection of actions. Now, if you'd like to know, I mean, I've written this, and I have some other ideas, too. There could be, if the committee started tomorrow, well, they need to wait for a little more information on one article. But right now, they could do an obstruction of justice article. And this would include, again, a number of actions. Trump demanding of Jim Comey, he wanted his loyalty. Trump telling Jim Comey, go easy on Mike Flynn. Trump going to other heads of intelligence agencies, telling them to tell Comey to go easy on Flynn. What that was quite about, we don't know yet. All of those things would amount to obstruction of justice, and there may be more. Trump saying, after he fired Comey, after they tried this sort of phony rationale for why he'd done it, he blurted out to Lester Holt, on my mind was this Russia thing. So it's not very subtle.
But one of the dynamics that happens back in the 1974 period, when the House committee is kind of the culmination of its proceedings, is that public opinion has changed. And another remarkable part of rereading is the book is that you are constantly wondering at the time how the public will absorb the events they're watching. At one point, you write, the close view we get of these events in our newspapers, our television screens, and in our gossip may seem to reduce their magnitude, but they remain the stuff of history. And then you write another day, the news is coming too fast, faster and harder than anyone expected. It's impossible to absorb. What finally led the public to absorb the magnitude of the constitutional test that the country was facing by the summer of 1974? Was it the bipartisanship that you talked about? Was it something else? How did the country reach that point to which Congress obviously responds?
Well, that's kind of two different questions. Two different parts of this. One is there was a gradual waking up to, you know, something very serious had happened. And you could say that the Irvin Committee, the firing of Cox and the Irvin Committee had helped get that, you know, get that going. But I would say mainly it was the Judiciary Committee proceedings. Not that it came from the center yet, but just the seriousness with which they took it, the debates or the discussions. People realized that these were serious people, you know, and the Republicans who ultimately voted for impeachment, and a number of them did on the committee, I mean, they took a long time to make up their minds. Or they appeared to, and I was talking to them all through this because they knew that I wasn't going to write anything until it was over. And they were agonizing. And so what the public saw, they didn't see that so much, but they saw serious people seriously debating, what is an impeachable offense? What is our responsibility? What does the Constitution tell us that we need to do? It was very high level in its tone. But it got across to people that there was a very serious proceeding, and these were very serious questions being addressed seriously by serious people, to use the word too often. But that, I think, that really was what did it.
Should we bring in the topic of what the House Judiciary Committee is like today?
Because not really. you know, it doesn't have to go to the Judiciary Committee. The House can decide. Tip O'Neill was the speaker, and he decided to have Rodina do this. But they can set up a special committee, which is what the Irvin Committee was. So, but we have a long way to go to get there, because the key thing is the Congress now is in the hands of the Republicans. And
currently,
I don't
that
rule
is true.
It out that there could be an impeachment proceeding against Trump at some point, even by the Republicans. It depends on what Comey finds. And what the country discovers. But then a number of people say, well, wait till the 2018 midterm elections. Maybe the House will change parties, and that changes a lot. So, you know, you can only speculate so much. I think the only relevant questions now is, do there seem to be impeachable offenses? I've already given you two. So, and another one that a lot of people talk about is the founders put into the Constitution the strange word emoluments. A president must not, and people prize it, must not accept emoluments from foreign leaders, potentates, and princes, it says. And what that meant was you should not be able to, and they were worried about their ambassadors, that they would be, in effect, bribed by the heads of the country where they were, or by powerful forces. And so it was very, the ambassadors were really hardly in touch with Washington at that point when they were drawing up the Constitution. So we didn't have ambassadors. That's what they worried about. So there's an argument that Donald Trump, by not getting rid of his businesses, by keeping them, and by accepting, mainly people focus on the Trump Hotel here in Washington. It's a couple blocks from the White House. And you see foreign embassies canceling parties that they used to give at other hotels to give it at the Trump Hotel. And there is a thought that, you know, other countries, foreign leaders try to butter him up by staying at the Trump Hotel. Now, that's there. I mean, serious people talk about that as another possible article of impeachment. Maybe there would be one on the flouting of the ethics laws and rules. But remember, these have to be serious offenses against the Constitution, not things in the criminal code. For example, impeachment for obstruction of justice has a looser standard than the criminal code on obstruction of justice. Under the criminal code, you have to be able to prove intent. Well, I think you can do it both ways with the set of facts I just gave you, because the fact that Trump had a pattern of trying to obstruct the investigation meant that there was intent there. And so I think he's vulnerable either under criminal code or as an impeachable offense. But let's say Mueller is still there. By the way, I mean, there's a lot of comment on Capitol Hill by Republicans as well as Democrats. If Trump tried to rid himself of Mueller, he could be in very powerful trouble. And so that's one thing would mitigate against it. But at some point, there's going to be a collision. Look, at some point, Mueller is going to demand his tax returns, and he's not going to do it. Those will be the tapes of this round. At some point, Mueller is going to want other information that Trump doesn't want to give him. We're not there yet, but that could happen, and we could have our little Cox-like moment.
When you watched the Nixon scandal unfold, one of your worries, and this is relevant today, was what it would do to the presidency. And you wrote, "We cling to the idea that the presidency is worthy of our respect because we want it to be." And then you wrote, "In linking his fate to the fate of the presidency itself, Nixon is making his ordeal ours. In trying through his office to protect himself against the damage from all that has happened, he has attached the damage to the office. This is part of what makes this such a painful time. It is humiliating to see a president subject to humiliation, whatever its origins." And then you write, "It's difficult to watch a president running and maneuvering like a hunted man." And part of what you worried was not simply the fate of Nixon, but really this fate of this institution that is at the center of our politics. Kind of looking back now, what kind of damage did Nixon's presidency and the scandal of Watergate have on the presidency?
Not much. And the reason for that is that in picking a new vice president, Nixon picked Gerald Ford, whom everybody liked. He was a kind of average guy, nice man, lovely wife, lovely family, all that sort of thing. And Gerry Ford, nobody thought that there was anything crooked about Gerry Ford. He was a very healing kind of figure. People kind of went nuts when Ford pardoned Nixon. Which meant that Nixon didn't have to, he had left office, so he could have been prosecuted and tried. And he couldn't have if he was still in office. So Ford, I think he was absolutely right. This country would have been in a complete uproar for months, if not years, while the prosecution and trial of Richard Nixon proceeded. And Ford, I thought he was quite right to say, "We've got to get this behind us. Time to put Watergate behind us," he said. "Our national nightmare is over," he said, "and get on with it." And I think that made a big difference in getting us back to normal. Ford was Mr. Normal, and Nixon seemed like a strange and frightening episode, but it didn't attach itself to the presidency. And some of what you read there, doesn't that have resonance for now, for people who feel very strongly that Trump is demeaning the office? And that's very upsetting to people.
Right. So the demeaning of the office has already happened. And so that's taken care of. What's left is to watch the facts unfold and watch what the House may do. I'm interested in the fact that we now have what I would call a statistical sample of impeachments. First, we have Andrew Johnson, a partisan railroad job. Then we have Nixon, a bipartisan investigation that led to his leaving office. Then we have Bill Clinton, which in retrospect was single acts that don't rise to the criterion of pattern and practice.
Excuse me. We knew that at the time. That's what was so difficult about it. It was clear this was another railroading job. We knew it was simply partisan, and it really wasn't a valid. It wasn't. The one lie to the grand jury wasn't enough to drive a president from office. It was not really an impeachable offense.
But what that highlights is that this polarized age that started around the mid-1990s, that the big transition from Nixon to now has been this age of intense partisan polarization, that if it's like anything at all, it's like maybe the Gilded Age, it's like the Reconstruction era. And now we're in that time. And so now we have this interesting situation in which we are going to find out what, if anything, rises to the level of a high offense in the coming year. And yet we do it under a partisan backdrop, conditions of intense partisanship. And that's a tough situation because now it's a test of American institutions that's unusually stressful, I think.
You're absolutely right. But I also say, let's see what Mueller finds. Let's see, you know, how strong it is, what it is. We don't know yet. There's a lot we still need to find out. So that could change things. And frankly, there's another aspect of the partisanship. I've long felt that, he hasn't been in office that long, but I have felt for some time that if the Republicans collectively, he'll always have his defenders, but if they collectively decide that he is destroying them and he's ruining the party or he's getting them all defeated, they might not be so loyal.
Well, on that note, I think we have to wrap up our episode. I want to thank again Elizabeth Drew. I urge all of our listeners to purchase a copy of Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and Richard Nixon's Downfall, which is out again. And really a classic, if not the classic work on Richard Nixon and the Watergate scandal, which obviously has important lessons for today. So thanks so much for joining us today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.